Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Deadline? What deadline? Congress takes its sweet old time passing a spending bill. We'll do cheap gas as a tax cut, and we'll talk about conflict minerals coming out of the Congo. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It's the 11th of December today. So listen, do you remember how I said yesterday Congress had left it until the last minute to agree on a spending bill? Yeah, well, joke's on me on that one. Lawmakers are still unable to agree on what the federal budget ought to be for the rest of this fiscal year. There have been recesses and delays and postponements today, with Democrats and Republicans in the House tangling over two of the most contentious provisions of that 1,603-page bill. One of them would raise limits on financial contributions to political parties. That one is relatively straightforward. But the other one? Yeah, well, let's just say it's not. It would repeal Section 716 of the Dodd-Frank Act, the official title of which is Prohibition Against Federal Government Bailouts of Swaps Entities, but which has come to be called in the vernacular the swaps push-out, because it would push some of the riskiest swaps, that is derivatives basically, really risky trades, out of the parts of banks that are backed by the FDIC, the insurance that protects your savings account. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn has our primer on this whole thing.
After the financial crisis, derivatives were the financial weapons of mass destruction that nearly brought down our economy. The push-out rule was proposed to put all those nuclear warheads a safe distance from our checking accounts. Mike Consol is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
The very first draft basically removed all derivatives.
But the big banks hated the idea. Not surprising, because they control the marketplace, and it is a big marketplace, according to Michael Greenberger, professor of law at the University of Maryland.
This market is a several hundred trillion dollar worldwide market.
But it wasn't just the self-interested banks. Even regulators like the FDIC's Sheila Bair and the Fed's Ben Bernanke gave it the thumbs down. Mike Consol says the rule that passed was massively scaled back.
We're really talking about a very narrow and small set of the market that tends to be the most risky.
Low-risk standardized swaps that farmers use to hedge their risks are allowed. Pushed out are the kind of credit default swaps that took down insurer AIG. Rolling back that regulation would mean more of those potentially toxic swaps would be held by the potentially too-big-to-fail banks. But supporters of the rollback, like Aaron Klein at the Bipartisan Policy Center, worry about the smaller hedge funds and bank subsidiaries where those swaps will be pushed to.
It's not only size, it's interconnectedness.
That interconnectedness means that even derivatives that aren't at the big banks could endanger the financial system. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
$59.73 is the macroeconomic number of the day today. It's the price of a barrel of oil at the close in New York this afternoon. The drop in crude, as you know, has led to a corresponding fall at the pump. A gallon of regular right now, as a national average, costs $2.62. So, all that money that we're not spending on gas, is it actually just as good as a tax cut, as a whole lot of people are saying? Sally Herships has that story.
First of all, how much does the savings we're seeing on our individual credit card bills all add up to? For gas, I mean.
Each of those barrels is costing about $50 in very round numbers. So that's $500 million a day.
Jeffrey Heal teaches economics at Columbia Business School. He says what we're not spending on gas adds up to hundreds of billions of dollars. But will it act as an economic stimulus?
Yeah, they will, definitely. They're giving consumers significantly more spending power.
But before you put New Pony and Castle on your Christmas list, Kent Smetters, who teaches business economics at Wharton, says consumers aren't planning on spending all of that.
They have a little bit more money at the same time their investments doing a little less well, so they don't necessarily feel that much richer.
Smetter says low gas prices could have a negative impact on the stock market, shares of oil-producing companies might go down, and as a result, so would our retirement funds, which puts us in the mood to save. Scott Wren is a senior equity strategist with Wells Fargo Advisors. He says we have seen low gas prices act as a stimulus in the past, but that was then. This is a recovering economy.
It's not going to be a big, big stimulus. In the past, people were more prone to increase their spending. They were more prone to borrow money as well, do things like home equity loans. And I think right now the mentality is a little different.
At least we still like a deal. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Sally was talking about low oil prices possibly being bad for stocks. Yeah, we'll get a load of this. Everything was groovy on Wall Street today, everybody, till oil broke $60 on the way down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All the oil that's moving through the economy, and I do mean moving quite literally, it has to get from point A to point B somehow, right? Train, truck, or barge. Austin Golding runs his family-owned barge line in Vicksburg, Mississippi. They do carry mostly petroleum products, and we talk to him every now and then to see how things are going. Mr. Golding, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, pleasure to talk to you, Kai. Thanks for having me.
I imagine, given the way the oil markets have been going the past couple of months, you guys are just all get out of town busy.
Business has been good this year, and as we've gotten into the winter months, we've been fortunate enough to still have a solid market.
Where do you guys get most of the oil that you carry? Are you bringing it downriver, upriver? Which way do you bring it?
Well, we do service a lot of upriver terminals that carry product all through the Ohio Valley, but we also service the Houston area and along the Louisiana corridor between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. So generally, if you find a refinery, you'll find one of our boats and barges loading product there.
Do you care what the price of a barrel of oil is, or do you just get it from one point to the other?
The price of the barrel of oil does affect my customers, and if business isn't good for them, it's not good for me.
Right.
But what we have found as an industry is that there is going to be a savvy customer out there that will find a way to make it work. So we just have to react to that.
Do you guys have seasonal variations in your business? I mean, we're approaching wintertime. I imagine the weather's getting worse up and down the river.
Typically in the summer, when you see more consumption of gasoline with travel, you'll see our business pick up. And there at the end of the year during the holiday season, you'll see it pick up also. There are no peaks and valleys. It's just seasonal surges.
Yeah. Let's talk about taxes and regulatory environments. The last time we talked to you, which was June, I just went and looked it up. A big waterways bill had just passed, and you guys were looking forward, I think it's fair to say, for some changes on the river thanks to the Army Corps of Engineers. Has any of that happened yet?
Well, you know, typically our projects are monumental, and they take a lot of funding and a lot of red tape and a lot of bureaucracy to get going. Now, we don't have anything brick or mortar, I can tell you, that has come out of the ground in the last 6 months. But what I can tell you is we're very optimistic as far as the infrastructure being taken care of and repaired and major rehab being done on a very consistent and streamlined basis.
You know, it's funny. You don't think about infrastructure and waterways, right? I mean, we all use bridges and highways and all that stuff. But of course, there's stuff you guys have to deal with, you know, locks and dams and all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely. I think something that has made America the country it is today that is very undervalued is our inland river system. Because it's so properly managed and because we're the envy of the world as far as having a super highway right through the heart of our country, it's critical that we maintain it and optimize it.
When was the last time you got to get out and actually drive a barge around the river?
Well, I was just down in Houston a couple weeks ago and got out and got to see some of our operation down that way. And I'm actually looking at the Mississippi right now as we talk. So as a boat comes by here in Vicksburg, Mississippi, a lot of times we'll jump out there and I'll get on and ride for a few miles and get somebody to come pick me up downriver.
Doesn't get any better than that. Austin Golding, he is the co-owner of Golding Barge Lines, as he said, in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Mr. Golding, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for your time.
The digital and social media news of the week comes to us courtesy of Instagram. The photo sharing site now has 300 million users, which makes it officially bigger than Twitter. Instagram now says that it's going to do a purge of all the fake and spam accounts in its files. So we asked Marketplace's Adrienne Hill to find out what fake and spam accounts are good for anyway.
Popularity matters. And online, you can buy it. Got $60? That'll get you 10,000 Instagram followers. For $100, you'll see your Twitter account explode by 50,000. Never mind they aren't real people. They count. Ari Lightman is a professor of digital media at Carnegie Mellon University.
Nobody wants to go to a party where there's only one or two people.
Fake followers can attract real followers and also real money. Alice Wright runs a snarky blog about bloggers called Get Off My Internets. She estimates as many as 70% of bloggers juice their social media stats because numbers, she says, drive advertisers.
They have to have the numbers. It's not just about your website stats anymore, you know, the hits and the comments. It's about social media.
And there's another value in fake accounts, and that's for the social media sites and services themselves. Karen North is a social media professor at USC.
It's always interesting to me when a company decides that they're going to go after the fraud, because at the beginning, the fraud is what helps them. It's like, wow, everybody's there. Look at all the big numbers.
A company or brand can start tossing those fake accounts, she says, when it's popular enough to be popular without them. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That's what McDonald's has identified as part of the problem, is that right now they're not relevant as they need to be.
Well, yeah, but now what are they going to do about it? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 63 points today. The 3% closed at 17,596. We'll call that just squeaking out a win for the blue chips. They were up 225 points at one point during the day. The NASDAQ closed up 24 points, about a half percent, finished at 4708. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, 4-tenths percent, ended things at 2,035. Good day out there for stocks making their debuts. Lending Club connects borrowers and lenders online. And boy, did it connect with investors. Shares up 56% on its first day of trading. Momo is an app for mobile chat, and its share shot up 25% in their U.S. trading debut. Momo, by the by, is backed by the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba. Maybe you've heard of them. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.17%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues the Producer Price Index for November. Secretary of State John Kerry concludes a two-day trip to South America with visits to Peru and Colombia. And tomorrow is National Poinsettia Day, held annually on December 12th, the death anniversary of Joel Roberts Poinsett in 1851. He was the first U.S. minister to Mexico and brought the Christmassy plant up from south of the border. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We were talking about the Dodd-Frank law up at the top of the show and how it's still playing out in political Washington. It is still playing out in the global economy as well. Case in point, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Congo is, for a whole lot of people, synonymous with conflict minerals, rare earth elements, and common ones, too, that you can find in your cell phone or your laptop. They're called conflict minerals because they helped finance some of the groups in eastern Congo that controlled the mines and that waged brutal rebel campaigns a couple of decades ago that led to the deaths of, by some accounts, 3 million people. Laws were passed, like Dodd-Frank, and campaigns were launched to take the conflict out of conflict minerals. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, they haven't had quite the effect they intended.
3 hours from the nearest city and 120 feet underground, at the end of a long tunnel just big enough for a person to crawl through, 25-year-old Nami Fusi is listening to his favorite music while digging. Fusi is a miner. He will follow purple seams in the orange clay down here, chipping away for 12 hours a day, hoping to strike it rich.
We move 3 feet, 6 feet per day.
He'll carry away piles of clay hundreds of feet through the tunnels to wash and sift it, looking, in this case, for gold.
Each day, every day.
There are 500,000 miners like Fusi in the Congo, and this is how a lot of the mining in the Congo has been done for the past few decades, by hand. Ores of the famous cell phone elements, the three T's, tungsten, tantalum, and tin, were mined in much the same way. Now, many things can shut a mine like this down, collapses, toxic gases, and it turns out, Dodd-Frank. Yep, that's right, the bill to clean up Wall Street.
Which in itself, I think, sounds a bit odd.
Alois Teguera is director of the Pole Institute, a think tank based in Goma.
There was this kind of strong American lobby. They wanted to slot into this American act something concerning Congo.
Within the 2,300-odd pages of Dodd-Frank is one small section, Section 1502, which requires companies that buy minerals from the Congo to certify whether or not those minerals are financing armed groups. The idea was to help put an end to the atrocities those groups were committing. There were campaigns waged on campuses, Facebook, and YouTube.
Major electronics companies need to step up.
I don't want my cell phone to fuel war. I want peace in Congo.
But they didn't really foresee the type of reaction, local reaction, how it was going to work.
Reaction was swift and dramatic. In 2010, many companies started looking elsewhere for minerals, and the government of Congo suspended all mining operations in the east of the country. Even when the suspension was eventually lifted, a lot of international companies realized they couldn't certify anything about Congolese minerals, not when the supply chain was dominated by long chains of middlemen and thousands of just regular people, just men and women with picks and hammers, some of whom couldn't read, let alone write official certifications. So companies just stopped buying.
They don't buy. These past few years, they don't buy anymore. I can't do this job anymore.
Gaspard Kashafali wearily stands on the side of a street in the city of Bukavu, far from the mines he used to work in.
Up until now, I have nothing in terms of money. I earn nothing. I don't work anymore.
Artisanal miners were all of a sudden unemployed. They were not working at all.
Tens of thousands of miners lost their jobs, says Tagara.
There is a lot of money which goes around that activity as well. We had, for instance, local traders who would sell spare parts, who'd sell food, who'd sell beer, etc., etc. These people also couldn't sell.
From the perspective of these people, there was no plan to prepare them for these consequences. Toby Whitney was legislative director for Congressman Jim McDermott. He was lead drafter of the relevant section of Dodd-Frank, and he bristles at the notion that drafters weren't aware of the consequences.
When you're going to break a black market and provide some chance for peace and prosperity in the region, there's going to be some dislocation. And it was worth some amount of dislocation to stop funding the killing of 1,000 people a day.
One of the leading organizations behind the Dodd-Frank section on conflict minerals is the Enough Project. Fidel Bafilamba is the Congo country director. He admits a lot of miners suffered under the rule, but he argues that people under the control of armed groups suffered without the rule.
The artisanal mining became synonymous with tragedy, malediction to the local communities.
And Bafilamba says despite the hardship, the law worked.
5 years back.
5 years back, most of the mines, especially three tea mines, were under control of armed militias. 67% of mines are conflict-free today.
That may be true for the cell phone mineral mines, but the opposite is now true for mines producing a much less controversial metal, gold, which now dominates eastern Congo's mining sector. Two-thirds of gold mines are now operating under some kind of armed group. That is because, ultimately, the armed groups don't care about the kind of metals the mines produce. Laura C. is professor of government at Colby College. Her research focuses on U.S. foreign policy in the region. All these groups care about is being able to make money.
According to the United Nations, about 8% of the conflicts are actually over resources. The other 92% of conflicts are not.
She says armed groups in DRC are funding themselves in all kinds of ways and very profitably.
They're very entrepreneurial guys. And so if you can't sell coltan or you can't sell tungsten, well, what else can we sell? So you have militant groups that are involved in the timber trade, charcoal, marijuana, poaching animals.
Ultimately, Say says the conflict in eastern Congo is much bigger than minerals. It's about ethnic divisions and identity, a weak to non-existent government, and money, or the lack of it. One thing that both proponents and critics of Dodd-Frank agree on is that it will take a lot more to solve those problems than any stroke of a pen by a foreign government. In Goma, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
McDonald's is in some trouble. The world's biggest fast food chain just isn't cutting it anymore. Sales are down, we learned earlier this week. Consumers are confused by all the menu options, and so a recovery plan is underway. Vanessa Wong is an associate editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. She wrote about the Golden Arches earlier. Vanessa, good to have you back.
Hey, Kai. Great to be here.
Put it into context for me. How bad are things at McDonald's?
Well, McDonald's recently reported that same-store sales haven't been positive since October 2013. So it's had a solid full year of...
Badness.
Of badness, of sales either being negative. And I think the best month was in April when same-store sales were flat in the U.S.
All right, then nuts and bolts. What specifically is McDonald's going to do? Because they've got like a whole agenda here. They actually call it something, right?
Right. So their plan is called the Experience of the Future. So back in July, McDonald's CEO Don Thompson said that the chain would be taking 18 months to reposition itself so that it wouldn't be seen by consumers as just an inexpensive place to eat, but also a desirable place to eat. So they're trying to engage with consumers and address some of their concerns about food quality, while also seeming to be more of a hip, relevant brand. And that's what McDonald's has identified as part of the problem is that now they're not relevant as they need to be.
Yeah. The idea of McDonald's repositioning itself as anything other than McDonald's, I mean, that's like 50, 60 years of rebranding they've got to deal with.
Totally. And, you know, there's still a lot of brand equity in McDonald's. Obviously, they're, you know, they're still the category leader, but there's just so much competition now in fast food, not only in the burger category, but also from the fast casual chains, which are still a small part of the market. But at a time when fast food sales aren't growing, they are stealing market share and preventing some of the larger chains from growing their sales.
They are also, you're right, going to offer table service in some places?
They are testing table service.
Wow. I don't know if I want that.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, maybe it's for the chill consumer who just wants a leisurely lunch. They're also rolling out this build your own burger test, which they've tested in a few restaurants in California. And they plan to roll this out in about 2,000 restaurants by the end of 2015.
And they've got, what, a year left in this 18-month plan that the CEO announced?
Yeah, so we'll know a little bit more by the end of next year whether or not this plan will work. But I think, you know, it's a difficult thing building relevance when, you know, you're competing on speed and price. And, you know, Starbucks does a fairly good job with its customer service. You know, they spell or misspell your name on your cup, but it does help you build like a relationship with your local barista. And I'm not sure if McDonald's has built the same types of relationships with its customers.
That's not what you want at McDonald's, right? You want the egg and muffin and a hash brown and you want to get out of there.
And you want to get out of there. And you might be just getting it in a drive-thru, too. Right. So, you know, there are challenges.
Vanessa Wong at Bloomberg Business Week. Thanks, Vanessa. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai.
We're going to the archives as we wrap up our 25th year on the air to pull out some of the series and stories that have stuck with us from 10 years ago and in keeping with the season. Here's one called Best Gift Ever.
This is Tom Wolfe. I'm a writer. The best gift that I ever received was a set of rubber dolls, which were the Seven Dwarfs. The movie Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was the rage of my youth. And I used to play with the Seven Dwarfs for hours. To me, they were alive. I'd seen the movie, and I could figure out what they would say in any given situation. Also, they were small, as we were, and I'm sure that must have been an attraction. When I was 9 years old, I wrote my first book, a biography of Napoleon. Here was a small person who had almost conquered all of Europe, and at nine, I was small too. I can't really explain the whole thing at all, but nothing made of silver or fine wood or really anything else ever meant as much as these little rubber dwarfs.
Tom Wolfe, he of The Right Stuff and Bonfire of the Vanities and a whole lot more. Our series, Best Gift Ever. Your best gift ever? Send us your story at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, John Brennan, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, held a press conference this afternoon in response to the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report that came out the other day. Never a company to miss an opportunity. Amazon has turned that report into an ebook, $2.99 for the Kindle version. It is number one, by the way, in the intelligence and espionage section. It's also free if you just, you know, Google it. Hardcover, by the way, coming out at the end of the year. No word on the price for that. All right, we're done. Today, the Dow up 63 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 24 points, a half percent. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.4%. It was better than that. And then oil fell through the bottom. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.